Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. For many of us, we are blessed to live within driving distance to Yosemite National Park, one of the oldest and most revered parks in America. But if you've made the day trip to the park on the weekend this summer, you've likely had to wait in bumper-to-bumper traffic to get in, only to find no parking by mid-morning once you finally pass through the entry gates. Congestion has been a long-standing issue at Yosemite, but the gridlock and lack of parking is testing the patience of many visitors, already prepared for crowds and long lines. Some are calling upon the park to reinstate the reservation system that was enacted the previous three summers during the pandemic. Joining us now to talk about these challenges and what people should know before they make the drive to the park this summer is Yosemite Park Ranger and spokesperson Scott Gettyman. Hello, Ranger Gettyman. Good morning.
Good morning, Vicky.
So, Ranger Gettyman, you joined us last in March after just a brutal winter. It has been quite the year for Yosemite National Park. At that time, we knew that the park had plans to drop its reservation system this summer, which had been in place since the pandemic. I mean, did you prepare, did you expect the level of traffic and crowds that you've been experiencing in the first, you know, week or two of summer?
Well, thank you, Vicky, and it's nice to be here with you again. As we know, back in March, in the winter we've had, one for the record books with the huge snowpack. And so what's happened is that this weather has created huge impacts. You know, for example, the Tioga Road is not open. We're still plowing the Tioga Road. We've got avalanche concerns up there. We are getting the Glacier Point Road open, some great news on Saturday. But the bottom line is that these weather impacts have impacted the park operations. And by that, I mean, you know, Yosemite is always busy. And when people come in June to see the waterfalls, we've got school out. So it's always a busy time. But this year, especially, as you mentioned, without the reservation system and without Glacier Point Road or the Tioga Road being open, it's certainly exacerbated some of the issues. But again, it's just a very popular place, as you noted.
And this comes as we're heading into a holiday weekend, right? What kind of projections or forecasts do you have with what attendance can look like starting this weekend through, you know, for really the whole week?
We're certainly anticipating, very busy days. And so we certainly ask people to, you know, come as early as they can. You know, we're seeing parking lots fill very early. So, of course, the earlier folks can get here and get a parking space and get on the trails is better. You know, also, if you can't come early in the morning, late in the afternoon is great. You know, a lot of the folks that come in real early in the morning, you know, by 2 or 3, they, you know, may be going back to their hotels or campgrounds outside of the park. So that will, you know, leave some parking spaces open. And so folks can come in the afternoon. So it's things like that. Also, if folks can come, for example, during the week rather than a weekend. So all of those things are ways to, you know, maximize your visit. But we are certainly looking at a busy holiday weekend. And we ask folks to just pack your patience. And that's the most important thing. And be you know, to just realize that there's a lot of people coming to Yosemite. We love the visitors. Yosemite, like all the national parks, belong to the American people, and we love to welcome the visitors. It's just a really popular time to visit the park.
Yeah, and Yosemite is such a popular national park. I mean, you welcome on average more than 4 million visitors a year. You know, I was one of those people that made the trip on a weekend, and, you know, I went through the traffic, which was fine. It was a weekend. I was expecting it. But it can take, you know, an hour or two just to get to the gate. And then once you get into the gate, it can take even longer finding parking. And we weren't able to find parking because by that time it was mid-morning. But that's okay, right? Because we're a drive, you know, within a drive distance away. How do you characterize the traffic conditions and visitor congestion? It was just packed in the valley these past couple weeks compared to previous years, because Yosemite is accustomed to having, you know, busy weekends.
You know, it's yes. And those are great observations, Vicky. And one thing to keep in mind is that, you know, we have had the reservation system, for the past 3 years for the pandemic and the construction. But before that, you know, going back to, you know, 2016, for example, where we had over 5 million visitors. And so it's certainly an issue that has been around, and I'll just introduce it here, which I think is really important. We are addressing it. We have a plan called the Visitor Access Management Plan, or VAMP. And this is a plan that is out right now for public review. In fact, our next round of civic engagement is opening next week, where we're asking visitors and Yosemite lovers such as yourself and many of the listeners here to, to weigh in. We're really looking at basically this huge challenge that we have and coming up with ways that we can both protect the park resources, provide for a quality visitor experience, provide for a safe visitor experience. And so it's one of those things that again, Yosemite has always been busy in this planning effort, is our opportunity to ask the public to help us come up with ways to, manage the access to Yosemite National Park.
I also really felt for the staff in the valley, just trying to corral, a very slow moving kind of chaotic situation in the valley. How's staff holding up? Because we're going into another holiday weekend.
Yeah, we're all doing well. It's interesting because, for myself and a lot of my, coworkers, it has been a tough winter, frankly, with a lot of the weather impacts, the atmospheric rivers, the rock falls, the rock slide. So it seems like we've all just been going. But, spirits are high, and it's a really great cooperative team effort. We love the visitors, and we know that it's June. It's the visitor season. And so, we certainly know it's going to get busier. But, as always, we're just supporting each other. And this is everything from, the rangers out working on traffic to the facilities. Excuse me, folks, cleaning bathrooms. We're all helping each other out, trying to cover each other where we can, and just really, protect the park and provide for the visitor experience. So yeah, it's certainly a lot going on, but spirits are really high, and I've been out and about a lot the last few weeks, and it's just been nice. And I'm always just reminded about how privileged I am, how lucky I am to have the coworkers that we have, both for the National Park Service and the concessioner, because we've got some really dedicated, wonderful people that are working hard and really want to make the experience the best that we can for the visitor.
When it comes to that brutal winter, I mean, Yosemite's still dealing with it, right? Tioga Road, which is the continuation of Highway 120 through Yosemite, if you're heading, through Mono County, up through the Eastern Sierra, it's still closed, and it's not planned to open ahead of July 4th. I've been seeing the updated videos of crews just doing that grueling work, just trying to clear the snow and the ice from the roadway. What impact do you think that's had on just the prolonged closure on visitor traffic in and around and access in and around the park?
Yeah, and that's a great point, Vicki. Tioga Road, which is the highest vehicular crossing over the Sierra, in fact, at Tioga Pass, it's 9,995 feet, just under 10,000 feet. And so, as you mentioned, with both the snow plowing, we've got avalanche concerns and avalanche zones we're mitigating now as the snow is melting. We're seeing some road damage. And so we're certainly trying to get the road open, but the impacts that it has is certainly it gives visitors less of a place to go. For example, when the Tioga Road is open, people coming from Mono County on the east side of the Sierra, what we call it, can come over. People, whether they're on the west side or in the valley, can go over and visit the beautiful Eastern Sierra. And so it's certainly impacting, traffic flow and movement around the park. And, we just want people to know that, that we are doing our best, and we will get it open as soon as it's safe to do so.
Well, let's get to some advice, because Yosemite has been good posting on Facebook and Instagram, on social media, just kind of advising and updating visitors throughout the days, especially Saturdays and Sundays. Last weekend, Yosemite advised visitors to arrive in the park before 8 a.m. So that's a pretty early morning, right? You're getting started around 5 or 6. You also outlined what the park experience would be like if they arrive after 8 a.m. So can you share what people's Yosemite experience will likely be if they don't really heed the advice over the next couple of weekends?
I think you characterized it well. But yeah, what we're trying to do through social media and our website is just basically let people know that, you know, people are coming mid-morning, for example, or midday. You know, there'll be long lines at the entrance station. You know, parking gets full. We've had to, you know, turn people around temporarily as parking lots fill. And so it's really challenging, and you know, we want to get people in, but you know, when there's certainly not, you know, enough parking space and not enough, you know, capacity for people, you know, that's just what to expect. Now, I will mention that there are ways, like for example, there's the YART system. This is a regional transportation system. This is a wonderful bus service that comes in from outside on the corridors, and people can, you know, and they don't have to worry about a parking space. You know, some of the businesses have, you know, vans that bring people in, some of the hotels. And so, you know, coming in on public transportation is another way. And then if people can avoid the weekends, you know, of course it's the holiday weekend coming up, but we're certainly busy, you know, 7 days a week, but the weekends, of course, are the busiest. And finally, I'll just say, you know, we ask people to pack your patience, you know, and be real patient. You know, we're doing the best we can. We welcome the visitors, but this is a situation where we're just doing the best we can to, you know, protect the park, get the visitors in, and provide for the best experience that we possibly can.
It's also important to mention what shuttle service within the valley looks like. I mean, I was pretty envious of people who are on bicycles.
Yes, but bikes are a great way to get around. Folks can bring their own bikes, or you can rent them in the valley. Bus service that goes around the valley is certainly full, and we have seen long lines for buses. And so we're working on adding more shuttle buses to the loop. And, you know, as we go along, you know, these are times that as we got into the spring and summer, you know, with all of the weather impacts that we talked about, with some of the, you know, projects that are, you know, still on construction that, you know, was delayed a little bit due to the weather. You know, these are things that we're just really trying to adjust literally every day as the park is open. So so that's why, again, this plan, this visitor access management plan, all the information is on our website, is really important, because we know, you know, a lot of people, you know, both here in California and throughout the world, love Yosemite, have been coming for a long time. And these are the people that we want to hear from. We want to hear from everybody, but we are really looking at just insights from people about, you know, ways that we can improve the visitor experience and manage the access.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Scott Gedeman with Yosemite National Park about traffic in the park on weekends. So you mentioned the visitor access management plan, and the goal of that plan is addressing congestion, also improving the visitor experience, and protecting the park itself, right? I mean, are there some concerns with the increased visitor traffic and the congestion, you know, impacting the preservation efforts at the park?
Yes, definitely. And that is part of the plan. So, for example, what we're seeing, you know, recently is with the parking situation that we discussed, we see people, you know, parking off the road, people going into the edges of meadows, you know, kind of really parking in areas that they should have. And this is impacting the resource. So, you know, with thousands of people, you know, we understand that people do want to, you know, park and get out in the trails. But yes, these resource impacts are apparent, and we're doing the best we can, you know, to mitigate them. But it's just a situation where, you know, people just really want to get out and see the park, which is so great and so wonderful. You know, I want to be very clear that it's just wonderful to see people excited and wanting to get out on the trails. But people also have to understand that, you know, we have impacts, and especially with vehicles. And so if someone's thinking, oh, I'll just pull off the road here, well, you pull off on a meadow, and then the next car pulls next to it, and the next one. And I have seen some parking over the past couple of weeks that I've never seen before. And so we ask people to just be really respectful and, you know, preserving Yosemite for not just now, but for future generations is incredibly important. And so we just, you know, really want people to be engaged in the plan and work with us and, you know, be our partners in stewarding this incredible national park.
What really struck me with the runoff, obviously the waterfalls are beautiful, but the Merced River, I mean, not to mention the other streams that go through Yosemite, they are a force right now. What advice do you have for visitors who, you know, they're going to get hot this weekend? I think temperatures are going to be in the mid to upper 90s, you know, and they might want to take a dip, but that's obviously not something they should do.
Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, our advice for the river and the water is to just stay back, to stay away. You know, the waterfalls are beautiful, and the Merced River, for folks that are familiar with it, you know, there's places in the valley where it just looks calm and looks placid, but, you know, the current is incredibly swift. This is ice cold water, literally melted snow. And so we ask people that, yes, we are expecting a heat wave. And I know I love to get out in the park and hike on my days off. And we know that someone gets off a trail and they're hot and that the river looks inviting. But again, just please, please, please stay away from the water. We're seeing some real high water. In fact, with the heat that we're expecting this weekend, we're anticipating even more runoff, which means more water in the river and the current even stronger, which of course, you know, is beautiful to see. And the Merced River is absolutely beautiful. But again, just really, really highlights the need for people to just, you know, stay away from the river and just enjoy the park and enjoy the waterfalls, but enjoy them at a distance. And there's plenty of places to see these, you know, waterfalls and enjoy the park without going near or in the river.
Finally, Ranger Gediman, in the last 30 seconds or so that we have, are there any conversations taking place about potentially reintroducing a version of the reservation system, maybe like only on weekends, for example?
We, after 3 years of the reservations, them this summer, as we talked about, the visitor access management plan will address those. And so right now we're just, you know, working on the current situation. And as we, you know, move forward in the plan, we'll see what the future brings us. But right now we're just, you know, working through and trying to get visitors in for a good visit. And hopefully things will, you know, we'll continue to have a good summer and people will be safe and have good visits to the park.
Scott, nice talking with you.
You too, always.
Scott Gediman is a park ranger and spokesperson for Yosemite National Park. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. If you head up to Tahoe this summer, you will be enjoying a crystal clear lake. In fact, the water in Lake Tahoe is the clearest it's been since the 1980s. You may remember a few months ago, we had Tahoe researchers from UC Davis celebrating a whopping extra 10 feet of lake clarity. And that's thanks in large part to the resurgence of native zooplankton. The zooplankton eat tiny little shrimp, which has plagued and clouded Lake Tahoe for decades. For years, locals and researchers have been working to improve Lake Tahoe's clarity. And a few years ago, former CAP Radio reporters Ezra David Romero and Emily Zentner went to the lake to find out what's eating away at the lake. For a deeper look, we're going to revisit CAP Radio's podcast Tahoe Land. This episode is called The Shrimp Problem.
I would love to go to sleep at night and not dream about shrimp.
How many shrimp are we actually talking about? Millions, billions?
Probably trillions. We trawled in the fall winter, and we were able to pull out about 3 to 3.5 million shrimp. That was a very small dent.
Humans put the shrimp into Lake Tahoe on purpose. Now UC Davis scientist Brant Allen wants to take them out. It's difficult work, but it could restore Lake Tahoe's clarity and preserve its blue hue.
If we can improve it and actually go back to clarity that we had before, I would love to come over Echo Pass as a 60-year-old and have it look like it did when I was 4.
These aren't just theories anymore.
I don't want the snow to go away.
Yes, Tahoe will change.
I kind of feel like that endangered pika.
Tahoe doesn't control climate change. It's a victim of it.
From Capital Public Radio, this is Tahoe Land.
It had always snowed by the third weekend in September, but that doesn't happen anymore.
I want to see our forest restored so that Tahoe doesn't burn the way paradise did.
Chasing the snow is a huge part.
It's about the lake. That's why everyone's here.
There are a lot of green lakes. There aren't very many blue ones.
I'm Ezra David Romero. Lake Tahoe has a shrimp problem. But they're not the big white and orange shrimp you get on a taco or on top of pasta. They're called mysis shrimp. Each one is about half an inch long and are almost translucent with big black eyes. They are voracious invaders, and they're changing the lake. Because of the shrimp, Tahoe's water might become green and slimy instead of crystal clear. The shrimp are a nuisance. If they stay and multiply, it'll be hard to keep Tahoe blue. But if we remove them, that might be a solution, one other communities all over the world could learn from. The shrimp might be a clue to tackling the effects of climate change. Welcome to Tahoe Land. It's the middle of the night, and I'm on a boat with Brant. We're here to catch some shrimp.
We're headed south out of Tahoe City down to Emerald Bay, one of the more scenic parts on the lake.
Introducing these little shrimp into the lake has completely changed the aquatic system. But how did they even get here? Well, it was the 1960s, and authorities in California and Nevada put them in there as fish food.
When I first got here, I was working on the deep living lake trout. At certain times of the year, they were stuffed full of these shrimp.
These shrimp don't like light, so they lurk near the bottom during the day. The lake is so deep that the fish can't see them, so they don't eat them. That whole fish food idea was a bust. And the shrimp population boomed. When the sun sets, the shrimp travel to the surface. That's why we're out here at night.
We just came into Emerald Bay, and this is really one of the jewels of Lake Tahoe. We're surrounded by snow-capped peaks, and the water here is just this beautiful emerald color. So this is where we're working on the shrimp, and we're looking at how to harvest them most efficiently.
The bad news is that the shrimp eat microscopic organisms called zooplankton that keep Lake Tahoe's water clear and blue.
And what we're going to do is we started down here kind of in the southwest part of the bay. We're going to transit the full deep length of the bay. When we get down to this end, we're going to make a U-turn.
This idea to remove the shrimp developed from a strange occurrence almost a decade ago. In 2011, the shrimp all but disappeared in Emerald Bay for no apparent reason. What happened next shocked researchers. The bay's water clarity doubled. It was clearer than the rest of the lake. The shrimp came back, though, and then the water got cloudy again. Now Brant's team is working to reenact that strange moment by removing the shrimp with nets at night.
All right, we got doors. Bring the boom in.
Katie Sempst is one of the researchers.
We'll go ahead and we'll grab a 5-gallon bucket, put a little bit of lake water in it, cut open the bottom of the net, so we can take a look at how many mysis we got.
Here's Brant's hypothesis. If they can take 75% of the shrimp out of the lake, its crystal clear glory measured in 1968 will return. Back then, you could see over 100 feet into the lake.
There's a lot of shrimp down there.
And they're moving.
Is this a typical night?
In the fall, we were averaging about 6 pounds per hour. This is probably maybe 4 pounds per hour, somewhere in that range.
But can this project be scaled up? Brant says so. His way of doing it is sort of radical, but it kind of makes sense.
You could potentially use a whole fleet of autonomous boats that left their slip when the recreational boating is done, go out and trawl, or use other techniques like pumping shrimp up and treating them with UV light or using that warm water treatment. When they're done, maybe at 4 a.m. before recreational boating starts, all of those autonomous boats go back and dock themselves in their slips. It sounds a little crazy, but the technology is there.
Envision a fleet of autonomous boats vacuuming up shrimp every night. They're kind of like Roombas on the water. This would take a lot of money and a lot of time, but it'd be huge for tourism and the lake's ecology. I asked Brant's boss, Jeff Schlatto, about this.
There's actually a lot of hope there.
there is a way forward on clarity. And where this ties in with climate change is that if you have a lot of the native zooplankton back, then even if sediments are coming in at the surface in a warmer lake, in a rain-dominated system, they're set up to deal with that. It may seem odd, but it's really saying the lake was doing perfectly well before we came here. Everything we can do to help it get back to how it was operating then can only be good.
Okay, let's take a step back. This episode is not just about shrimp, although I had no idea they were here in the lake when I started reporting this project. There are persistent leafy green aquarium plants in Lake Tahoe. They expand and they take over the lake's shorelines. There's also cannibalistic bullfrogs in Lake Tahoe and a whole slew of fish that just don't belong. All these species are invaders, and they're changing the Lake Tahoe we know. But Tahoe's not alone in the fight against invasive species. Creatures and plants are spreading all over the world as warming temperatures transform the places we love. In this episode, we're going to look at the people who are fighting back against these species. So the first question our colleagues asked us when we started this story was, can we eat the shrimp? So our data reporter, Emily, and I tried them.
Mm-mm. Honestly, it doesn't taste like anything.
They feel like something, though.
You're right, they're not good.
You're right, I don't like it.
You're right.
So Emily's here with me now to relive this experience. What up, Shrimpette?
What up, Shrimpette? So I think the question here isn't if you can eat the shrimp, but if you should eat the shrimp. So they were really gross, and it was kind of like chewing on crunchy, oily bugs. And I really don't know how we talked ourselves into doing this.
Yeah, I don't either. They were pretty gross. But once we mentioned it to the UC Davis team, they were like, do it.
Yeah, there was no going back.
Before we get into the process of all this, let me get this straight. People put the shrimp into the lake, and now we're living with the consequences when you go visit Lake Tahoe.
Yeah.
What else did you learn about this?
So I spoke with one of the parties that's responsible for putting the shrimp in the lake, the Nevada Department of Wildlife. And they teamed up with the California Department of Wildlife in the 60s to put these shrimp in the lake. And they know now that they messed up. They've seen the consequences. And the biologists who were involved in it feel remorseful. But basically, hindsight is 20/20, and they just didn't understand then, like we do now, what these shrimp could do.
So instead of being this great fish food, they're also eating this zooplankton, right? And those zooplankton help clear the lake. How do they do that?
Yeah, so these zooplankton, they're called Daphnia, and they're kind of like water fleas, and they play this huge role in clearing the lake. So they eat the algae and dirt that makes its way into the water, and then they poop it out, and these little poop pellets fall to the bottom of the lake. So basically, Daphnia poop, through this gross process, is cleaning the lake water.
They're kind of like little vacuums.
Yep, that is exactly what it's like, and that's part of why Tahoe is so clear. The other really cool thing about these Daphnia is that they're kind of crustacean feminists.
What?
Yeah. So Daphnia are this kind of matriarchal species because they can reproduce normally between females and males. But when there's a lot of food and they really want to boost that population, female Daphnia can just clone themselves and produce tons of tiny clone daughters.
So they're just like, what? I don't need a man to boost my population?
Exactly. But there were literally zero Daphnia per cubic meter in Emerald Bay at last count. There should be thousands of them.
Wow, how come so little? Like, what's going on?
So these are some hungry shrimp, and they have eaten up all of these Daphnia. Katie Sempt from UC Davis explained it to me in a way that really made sense. Daphnia, they're kind of like cows. They're really slow, but they're also really efficient at eating. Meanwhile, the other zooplankton, they're kind of like rabbits. They just zip around really fast. Here's Katie.
So if you're a mysid shrimp swimming through at night, who are you going to eat? You're going to eat the cow. But then you have these inefficient grazers, the rabbits that are left, and the field gets overgrown and you lose your clarity.
So is this problem fixable?
So we started off this podcast in Emerald Bay where Brant Allen is trying to see how we could reduce the shrimp population. He would really like to see the number of shrimp down to about 25 per square meter, but that would be a huge reduction from where we're at now. If we got the shrimp down to the level that he wants, the Daphnia population would grow back and they could clear the lake like they're meant to.
And that would totally change Emerald Bay. And then if it went to Lake Tahoe, this could be a solution for clearing the rest of the lake, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're obviously obsessed with shrimp now. I hear you even have an outfit.
It is a crawdad outfit, Ezra.
But I understand you have some more work that people can look at.
Yeah, so my shrimp fascination has manifested as an article. It's at capradio.org/TahoelandShrimp. And if you go there, you can find some really awesome videos, photos, and graphics to help you understand the huge impact these shrimp are having on the lake.
Yeah, the graphics are awesome. I love how the fish move and the shrimp go up and down. You can see the levels. Mm-hmm. It's really cool. Thanks for joining me today and talking about shrimp and telling me about your obsession.
Of course, Ezra. I am ready to talk about shrimp and Daphnia, always. Thanks.
Even if the shrimp get under control, there are still other invasive species in the lake, like crawdads, bass, catfish, and 3-pound goldfish. And then there are these cannibalistic bullfrogs. Sarah Muskoff and I are attempting to catch some bullfrogs at Taylor Creek on the southwest side of the lake.
Oh, yuck! Did you see it was right in front of us? There it is! Oh my God.
Get it. I saw it. Oh my gosh. It was ugly.
It was huge. I almost stepped on it. Oh my God.
Sarah's an aquatic biologist with the Forest Service in the basin. She says Taylor Creek has the largest population of American bullfrogs in all of Tahoe.
They're considered one of the 100 most voracious invaders in the United States. They're the largest frog in North America. They're cannibalistic. They say about 80% of their diet is other bullfrogs.
We're hunting them because Taylor Creek embodies all of Tahoe's climate change challenges.
Every warm water invasive fish that we have in the basin is also present in this system. The good, the bad, and the ugly are all here, reaping the benefits of this really great habitat.
They do so well because the shallow water warms fast. As the climate changes, this creek will most likely be dominated by non-native species.
Taylor Creek has the highest temperatures of any stream to date. So although it has some cold water habitat right now, come August, it's reaching that threshold where it's lethal temperatures to a lot of our native species, but not our warm water species.
Lethal temperatures. That means more predators and plants crowding out native ones. That's why we're chasing bullfrogs. Sarah wants to give native species a fighting chance to thrive, even as temperatures change.
What'd you get? Nothing? Oh, you were great.
Invasive species aren't just threatening Tahoe. They're spreading around the world, and if they aren't controlled, the invasions could intensify. Carrie Brown Lima is the director of the New York Invasive Species Research Institute based at Cornell University.
The looming fear is really of a species that has nothing to keep it in check.
Carrie says removing invasive species is tough. Scientists are often just learning how climate change is influencing them. And the fear is that species will spread to new ecosystems.
Projections show the Northeast is probably one of the areas that the climate is going to change more and become better for a lot of these invasives to move north, where in fact it might become too warm for other invasives to take over in the south.
This reminds me of the bark beetle that killed more than 129 million pine trees in California during the recent multi-year drought. A similar bug is moving north on the East Coast. It's called the southern pine beetle.
I was speaking with a researcher who studied this. He lives in New Hampshire, and he says, you know, every year I have to drive less to reach my research sites just because this species has just been moving north at such a steady rate.
I think one of the most fascinating cases of invasive species has to do with snakes in Florida.
Florida is a really crazy invasive species hotspot. The Burmese python escaped into the wild and has just been able to reproduce. Apparently, the climate in Florida is perfect for them throughout the Everglades. It's just been really feeding on all of their native small mammals, which is their normal prey, but our mammals here aren't adapted to them.
And that's why Carrie says it's important that we take action.
Sometimes invasive species seem like this insurmountable problem. And yes, we're never going to get rid of all the invasive species, but we can slow their spread, and we do have a role and a responsibility in that.
Let's talk about responsibility for a second. We haven't always been great stewards of Lake Tahoe, but there is work being done. We're doing more boat checks to make sure invasive species don't make it into the lake. But Jesse Patterson says more can be done. He's the Keep Tahoe Blue guy from episode 1.
Pump it up.
Workout. Boot camps. Tahoe boot camp.
Right.
We're pumping up blow-up paddle boards as fast as we can because mosquitoes are fierce here. We need to get moving.
They're pretty big. You can, like, feel them biting you.
We're making our way down the Truckee River in South Lake Tahoe. It's hard to tell from the paddleboard that the subdivision of homes is on the other side of the trees. It looks just like a forest.
Focus up here. Yeah, just don't hit the bushes is basically what that means.
Okay, so go wide.
Be the river.
Be the river, Ezra.
Right when we got into the water, something crazy happened. A black bear crossed the river in front of us.
There is a bear? Woo! That's cool. Might have been the same bear I saw earlier.
We're paddling to what Jesse says is the Venice of Tahoe. It's called the Tahoe Keys. It was one of Tahoe's biggest wetlands, and a large part of it was dredged in the 50s and 60s, and then replaced with 1,500 homes alongside canals.
The Tahoe Keys is the poster child of a mistake. It was done, you know, not with ill intention. It was just put in a bad location. Particularly, it was in this giant marsh meadow that used to be a filter. Not only did we remove the filter and break it, essentially, we added pollution on top of it.
Today, the Tahoe Keys pose a new threat to the lake's pristine shoreline. The shallow, warm canal water is perfect for invasive fish and weeds to flourish.
Boat traffic jam?
Yeah.
With so many people coming in and out of the Keys, boat propellers chop up the weeds.
So the problem is all these pieces of plants on the top of the water?
Yep, that's it. These are the fragments, and you'd be like, why does these little fragments matter? Well, if you look at some of them, they already have sprung roots. So every one of these fragments could turn into a new plant, it could turn into a new infestation. And before climate change, there wasn't much space for them out there. Now the lake's a lot warmer, and we're finding more and more places where these plants can establish and grow and spread.
Each little fragment can ruin a whole beach. Imagine walking up to the shore, and instead of seeing slabs of granite through the water, you see a gooey green mess. The weeds change the soil, the water turns green, and then invasive fish come.
The main reason now is that the lake's warming up. So the conditions outside the lake along the shoreline are now much more similar to what's inside these man-made lagoons. Particularly in the last 5 years, our average water temperature at Tahoe has increased 10 times faster than the previous 40.
The Tahoe Keys are here to stay. That's why there's an effort to figure out ways to stop these little shards from leaving the lagoons. It's all about buying time until a long-term solution emerges. One idea? Bubbles.
There's a perforated tube running the length of the channel, and it's creating literally a wall of tiny bubbles that goes all the way to the surface. And the plant fragments floating anywhere in the water column can't get past it, and get pushed to the top and then to the edges. If you look right over the side now, it'll get pushed right into that sea bin right over there. See that passive skimmer against the wall? It's like a fancy trash can.
There might be other ideas too. They're choking out plants with black mats, mowing the weeds with an underwater trimmer, and thinking about using a water-based herbicide. But what everyone pointed out to me, the best way to keep invasive plants and animals out of Lake Tahoe is to never put them there in the first place. And yeah, that's a simple idea, but so many species have been added to the lake by us.
And that was Ezra David Romero, host of Cap Radio's Tahoe Land podcast, released in 2019. You can find more episodes by searching Tahoe Land on your favorite podcast app or on the Cap Radio website. Just click on Cap Radio Originals. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Sacramento may feel small compared to our larger neighbors to the west and south, like San Francisco and Los Angeles, but there is a lot going on in our backyard, from news of the day to fun events, as well as even exploring local history. It really can be a lift to sort through what makes Sacramento so special and really to feel connected and informed. Well, Cap Radio has found a fun, fresh new way to deliver all of that and more to an inbox within your fingertips. Cap Radio digital editor Claire Morgan and Northern California reporter Janelle Salonga are the curators behind Sacramento, an email newsletter delivered every Tuesday and Thursday, where Claire and Janelle bundle up local headlines, explore the region, round up events, share Sacramento history, and pass along moments of joy. Hey, Claire and Janelle, nice to see you.
Hey, good to see you, Vicky.
Yeah, what a cool newsletter. I'm really enjoying the email drops for, you know, every Tuesday and Wednesday now. I think we're like on our sixth one so far for June. How did this idea come about?
Yeah, we were thinking a lot about, or at least I was thinking a lot about kind of conversations that I have with friends and family members who aren't in news. Of course, we have a lot of news colleagues, but those conversations kind of come from a place of context. You know, I've been covering the Sacramento area for the entirety of my career. Just kind of coming from a place of understanding and knowing the area and the region and kind of contextualizing that and summarizing it for readers every morning.
Yeah, and I think to add to that, for me personally, I think sometimes Sacramento can get a bad rap because, like you said, it's not as big as some of, you know, like neighboring metros, San Francisco or Oakland. And so I really wanted to work on a project like this that kind of highlighted, you know, all the things that make Sacramento what it is and give context, like Claire said, to this region and the news that is happening, because sometimes it can be like, I know that especially when it feels like there's so much news and so much local news to consume, it can kind of all go over your head. And so I wanted to hopefully make this something that people could, you know, look at in the morning and feel like, oh, you know, we're getting our dose of local news in a way that doesn't feel like condescending or overwhelming.
Yeah, or heavy, you know? Yeah. Like, who wants to start their day with, like, really heavy stuff, right? When there's obviously a lot of other email newsletters that people can sign up for. When you were seeing or following or receiving these newsletters, what were you seeing that was lacking that the both of you wanted to, you know, fill that gap?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing is you'd mentioned, you know, our local events, and that's one section of the newsletter that we felt has sometimes been lacking. I think a lot of email newsletters will be, you know, primarily tilted towards sharing events or sharing local news. And so we wanted to include, you know, some of those events and make sure that we were including, you know, an array of things that are related to civic engagement, to sober events, to paid events or free events, depending on people's level of access to things. And also, you know, sharing more about local history, because like you said, it can also be, you know, you might want to explore more of Sacramento's local history, but you don't know where to start.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you have a good one this week, you know, when learning about Sacramento and just being an ag area and produce and all of that. Did you have a reader in mind when you were kind of creating how you wanted the newsletter to look and feel like, Claire?
Yeah. Yeah. We're thinking a lot about busy Sacramentans who are just kind of wanting to stay connected. But, you know, the news world is so vast that they're looking to kind of find everything in one place. So, you know, looking to stay informed about their community, wanting to stay connected to their community, and also kind of looking for little moments of joy along the way. The other thing is, I also wanted to create something that I myself would engage with. And I think that, you know, I hope that, well, I think that I would engage with it if I were a reader. But I also think a lot about, you know, just kind of joy and connection and people who are really looking for those things. Sacramento is a really unique place. It's a really small town feel in a big city. And I think that kind of trying to convey that information To people who understand that is what we were looking for.
Yeah, I love that the newsletter is so vibrant. It's very colorful. It's easy to read. It's not like just, you know, a bunch of links and kind of like, you know, what is it, Times New Roman, like font 12, you know? There's a lot of fun that's had with it, and that makes it enjoyable to take in and experience. I also love the name Sacramento, and it's not T-O, it's K-N-O-W. Who came up with the name Sacramento?
Yeah, so that was actually our Cap Radio's graphic and digital media designer, Marissa Espiritu, who is also behind, you know, all that vibrant, colorful design work and branding that you see with the newsletter. So she thought it connected, you know, the newsletter's mission to provide a guide to the Sacramento area, to, you know, the city's name, so people would know, you know, what we're writing about. And, you know, kind of tip the hat to this very specific pronunciation of Sacramento that omits the T. And when she said it during this brainstorming session, like, the entire team, you know, gasped, because I think we all kind of knew it was the one.
Oh, yeah. It that's like the name. I don't know how you top that one. Why Tuesdays and Thursdays for the email newsletter drop?
Yeah, I think we both kind of wanted to serve both audiences in the early week, you know, kind of as you're getting your grasp on what's happening, kind of recapping the weekend. And then we also wanted to serve audience in a late week capacity, so kind of setting you up for the weekend, what you need to know. We'd also love to increase our frequency, but, you know, all in due time.
Yeah, right. Well, both of you are very busy, you know, because both of you are journalists at Cap Radio well before this newsletter. You wear many hats here. It's not your only job. But what does the newsletter add to your reporting and digital pieces that you're already part of?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me personally, it offers like a chance to expand on, it's kind of like insight a little bit, but in written form, I feel, you know, getting to have these conversations about stories that I've worked on, or conversely, you know, talk with my coworkers about the stories that they've worked on and help them kind of showcase their stories in a different light, which is another reason I've really liked, you know, working on the newsletter, because it really increases this kind of across newsroom collaboration. Mm-hmm. We're all kind of working together to share this information that can be really helpful and useful for folks.
Yeah. And I imagine, Claire, I mean, you said yesterday, I think when we were talking, it's been enjoyable for you.
Oh, my gosh. It is one of the most fun projects I think I've ever worked on. I really love Sacramento, and I know that Janelle feels similarly. So to be able to report and kind of condense news, aggregate news for people who really also care about Sacramento is a really good feeling.
All right. So we only have a handful of newsletters in. This just launched a couple weeks ago. What have been your favorite kind of segments or parts of the newsletter so far?
I can start us off. I love all of the history segments. At the end, we have a local legend and Sacramento history section, which I've really enjoyed writing. I think I spend more time than I probably should sifting through the Sacramento History Museum archives. The photos are so cool, and we've been trying to include some of those. I also spoke with a linguist who told us about why Sacramentans do not pronounce, or I guess Californians do not pronounce the T in Sacramento. So that was quite interesting as well.
Yeah, I learned that there's a lot of other city names that don't get pronounced with T's, like Santa Ana. But I think as for me, some of the favorite segments I've worked on, I really like the Kennedy Gallery segment that I was able to work on last week, just because I think it's, especially since, you know, it's Pride Month, I thought it was such a, it was really amazing to get to commemorate or honor, you know, the presence that this gallery has had in the community.
And that's in the Lavender Heights District.
Yes.
in Sacramento,
yeah.
And it's closing.
Yeah, yeah. And so if you want to go, it's open today and tomorrow, and it's in Midtown. I also enjoyed working on the segment about the budget, which may not seem like something super exciting, but I think that's one of the joys of this newsletter is, like I said earlier, is kind of taking this news that might seem really heavy and getting to bring it to folks so that they can better understand like what it means or what it looks like. So for example, like that story was about, you know, how police funding in Sacramento is reaching a new high. And so things like that, you know, are just things that you can hopefully take with you in your day to day and just know so that you're better informed in the way that you move through your life.
What kind of feedback have you two received so far?
A lot of really positive feedback, which has been super exciting. From both colleagues, from people who are receiving the newsletter, from friends and family. So yeah, it's been really positive.
Yeah, I would imagine. I know it's been a hit here at CAP Radio, and I can only imagine with people who are not journalists as well. Well, Claire and Janelle, thank you so much. I mean, it's such a cool newsletter. I enjoy getting it to my inbox every Tuesday and Thursday.
Yeah, thank you so much, Vicky. Thank you.
And that is CAP Radio digital editor Claire Morgan and Northern California reporter Janelle Salonga. And they are discussing launching the new Sacramento newsletter, and it is emailed every Tuesday and Thursday. We have a link to subscribe to the newsletter on our Insight page. It is easy to find at capradio.org, and there's an even easier link. It's capradio.org/no. So with that, that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or really wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to join the conversation, shoot us an email, insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Arm Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minada. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Antonio Munez and Chris Feltz. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We are off for the holiday week. We'll catch you back here in July. Have a great holiday week.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.